This is CliffCentral.com.
The Battle of Isandlwana, which happened on the 22nd of January, 1879, was the first major encounter in the Anglo-Zulu War between the British Empire and the Zulu Kingdom. 11 days after the British commenced their invasion of Zululand in South Africa, a force of 20,000 warriors attacked a portion of the British main column consisting of 1,800 soldiers, colonial native troops, probably about 400 civilians involved there as well. Now, the Zulus were equipped with the traditional assegai, the iron spears, the cowhide shields, but also a number of muskets and old rifles. And the British had the modern Martini Henry breech-loading rifle, as well as a Hale rocket battery. Despite a vast disadvantage in weapons technology, the Zulus ultimately overwhelmed the British, killing over 1,300 troops, including all of those out on the forward firing line. The Zulu army suffered anywhere between 1,000 to 2,500 casualties. Now, it was a major and decisive victory for the Zulus and caused the defeat of the first British invasion in Zululand. But the British army suffered its worst defeat against an indigenous foe with vastly inferior military technology. And Isandlwana resulted in the British taking a much more aggressive approach to the Anglo-Zulu War. And I love history. You know that I love history. I'm delighted to talk today to a guy who's put together a show around the Battle of Isandlwana. His name is Mbuso Khoza. He is a musician, a historian, and a master's student. Mbuso, it's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
How are you, Baba?
I'm very good, and I'm kicking ass.
I hear you came up from Durban today.
Yes, I drove.
Yeah. Okay, so yes. Well, thank you very much for spending time with us. So I see you kicking ass because this is not the first time the Joburg Theatre is putting together a second edition of the Isandlwana Battle Musical Lecture, which starts on the 24th and goes until the 26th of January.
Yes.
So this has happened before. It was so popular, you're doing it again.
Yes. I planned like one night only because I was skeptical because of January. People are worried about finances.
Sure.
Yeah. So then on the week of the show on Monday, it got sold out, and then I was asked by Joburg Theatre to add another one. Within a day, it was sold out. We added a third one. Same thing happened.
It's amazing. You see, I love this because I do love history. I love the story of the Battle of Isandlwana. We learned it at primary school when I went to primary school in Natal, and they taught us this as an important part of the curriculum. Mm. But I find like a lot of young people are not as interested in history. So this gives me enormous happiness to know that there's so many people who want to come and see the show. Do you want to explain how it all started?
Firstly, the inspiration behind this is that the overall commander or general commander of the battle is Jingwai Kwamahole Khoza, and his tombstone is at home. So I grew up with this heritage.
So it's in your blood.
Yes. I started working as a jazz musician. I won an award. But as I move along, I'm like, something is missing in our history in terms of instrumentizing our heritage within the music. For instance, when you look at the Americans, when they were taken here around 1619, August to America, and they were enslaved, and there was music that came out of those experiences, like Abo Swing Oh Chariot,
right?
Come for yes,
carry me home, right?
Yes, that's their. They managed to safeguard their history through the music, and when you check in the olden days from 1500th century during the times of King Malandela, people used music to document history.
Absolutely.
Because they could not write. So now I was looking at this, and nothing has been done around this indigenous music called Amahubo. So that's when the inspiration came from, and then I started to research from 2013. And then later I formed a group called African Heritage Ensemble. And then from there I asked myself, what next? Okay, I need to do different shows now, not your usual shows where you go on stage, ladies and gentlemen, the next song is, but position our heritage as a subject of daily consumption.
I love that. So it's part of people's lives now. It's not just something that they learn once.
Not something that is meant to please tourists.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I've observed, I mean, these cultural shows, when they are tourists, people tend to overact or over-exaggerate. And then the Zulus! And then, but that's
it's entertainment rather
yes.
rather than a lecture.
Exactly. Exactly. So I thought, I mean, let me try to come up with something different where you stand in front of an audience, sing beautifully and able to articulate the history, narrate it, give the accounts of the events and also give them the historical background of these songs as well as the usage of language.
That's magnificent. Who are the main audience that come to this? Are they people who are interested in history? Are they people who just want to be entertained? Is it a mixture of both? Are there a lot of Zulus who are coming because they want to hear the history sung properly, the way that their ancestors would sing it before and pass it on to generations before theirs?
You would be surprised. I mean, I saw a five-year-old screaming in the audience. And after the show, he came straight to me. He left his parents and just gave me like a tight hug. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he understood what I was saying. And another thing, there was a group of Sotho people, like 15 of them. After the show, they called me aside. They said, "We just want to talk to you. We just want to tell you that we love the way you articulated the history without glorifying the Zulu nation, but telling the history as it is with an aim to unify people, because we are suffering from, tribalism. Mm. It's there, and we like it or not. So now us as musicians, it's our job as well to heal the nation, combine people, I mean, unite people together, make them understand that in the end, we are one. So yeah, the audience that came there, it was a mixture of people. It was not only Zulu-speaking people. In fact, I am enjoying more support from non-Zulu speaking people.
How did you, I mean, I understand now a little bit more about how the process happened, but how did you put together in your head the idea of this being a show? Because a lot of people have passion projects, but it never really leads to commercial value.
True.
And it's hard to find the kind of story that, and this is a famous story.
Yes.
I mean, it's well documented in history. It's something that most, I would imagine, most people grow up knowing something about in KwaZulu-Natal.
True.
And, you know, the little things, like, for example, I didn't know about Nchingwayo.
Yes.
Your ancestor. But the fact that he was this powerful Nduna who commanded the battle.
He was 74. They say between the age of 74 and 76.
At the time of the battle?
10 kilometers apart, the regiments, because the formation of the battle was the horns of a buffalo. King Shaka used
Shaka
the
came
horns.
Up with that.
No, King Shaka used the horns of a bull.
Oh, okay, so this is a different shape.
It was a different shape. And 10 kilometers apart, and he was singing. If he had to move from that point to tell the other wing that this other wing is stop attacking, it's your turn now. He was running and singing at the same time.
In his 70s.
So that's what she's, running, you know, and also interceding, calling upon the departed kings. It's amazing at his age that he was able to do that.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. So those are the aspects of the history that are mostly overlooked. People, they always look for what happened. Oh, then they killed each other. Yes, they killed one another. But what can we learn from this in the modern day?
You've been to the battlefield.
Many times.
And tell me, do you get a feeling when you're there that makes it easier to tell the story? Is it hard to explain to people who haven't been before what it feels like there?
You know, imagining my greatest ancestor, you know, walking barefooted from Ulundi to Isandlwana. Mm. You know, thinking about that sometimes it brings so much joy, yet tears. So it makes me, you know, so exuberant. you know, when I'm narrating this history, because these pictures are playing, because I grew up, as part of the regiment when I was young.
Yeah.
I was part of the culture, practicing the culture, fighting the stick fight, the Zulu dance and all of that. So I have a clear picture of the formation of the battle and on what took place. So when I'm narrating it, it goes straight to the heart.
But it also sounds like a matter of some pride, and I am completely understanding of that, because this was a major victory. It was a big deal for the Zulus.
It was a major victory. However, it was just a victory on a battlefield. If we were to do the aftermath.
Oh, sure. Sure. What happened to Khoza?
He died long after the battle. He survived because he was...
Because we know what happened to King Cetshwayo.
Yes, King Cetshwayo, he died a broken man.
Hmm.
The English people made sure that they devastate him severely. To an extent that, because he passed away in Eshowe, in the north of KZN. And then he was supposed to be buried with other kings in the north next to...
His father was Mbande.
Yes. He was supposed to be buried with other kings. And Osborn Melmoth said no. They were with Shepstone. They said no with the regiment, with the soldiers. And then because days were piling up, they tried to use some traditional spices on his body, but the body could not take it anymore. So he was taken to Inkandla.
Yeah,
that's why he was buried. Unjingwayo, his tombstone is at home in Eshowe, where I was born.
Wow!
They just erected his memorial stone there.
And at the battlefield at Sanjwana, are there memorials there as well?
Yes,
I haven't been.
Yes, but the most disappointing part is the museum. It's very small. It's like it's the size of this room, almost.
So it's a little 5x5 square meters.
Yeah. And if you look there, I mean, they're just pictures, and there's nothing that evokes maybe some spirits when you get there, like a full picture of what happened. You know, we know the history because we were lucky enough that we met the elders who were passionate about the history. But in terms of the documentation, for me, they focused more on the study that I'm doing at VETS, popular memory versus public memory.
But this is interesting because sometimes the popular memory catches things that the public records don't.
Yes.
Right. Like, for example, when you said the singing just now, and maybe the historical record, the written record, doesn't reflect things like the weather.
Yes.
Or the emotions. Yes. Or the individual stories.
Yes.
As well. And I think the oral tradition probably does, huh?
Yeah, though there are challenges with the orality in the documentation of history, because people, they have different agendas.
Yeah, some exaggerate, some play it down.
Yeah.
Some people make themselves more important in history than others.
And others tell history according to what they wish it could have happened.
Yeah.
So that individual biasness always takes place. So we always have to verify this, how empirical is the knowledge that is presented to us. But yeah, I mean, popular memory versus public memory, it's a challenge. Because if you look at the story of Nelson Mandela and you look at the story of Steve Biko, Mandela is a popular memory.
Hmm.
Steve Biko is a public memory.
Right.
So it's a similar story with the band of Isandlwana.
So this Amahubo music.
Yes.
Just tell me how that factors into how people record history as well. How does it come about? Yes. Who writes these songs? Who sings these songs? Who learns and who teaches?
It's interesting, man, when you look at people like Mozart, Ave Maria.
Yeah.
He's glorified as a greatest composer of all times. But in our culture, it's different. Song get composed by a community or a village.
Mm.
I'll give you an example. If we're in a wedding and food takes longer to come, and then when it comes and you see people who are not even part of the family directing, no, don't take those plates to that side, take them this side. There are more people who need food. And then you'd see people starting to complain. I doubt you're going to get this food, man. Everyone is now taking over. From that complaint, you would hear saying, Nongebani kuyakhuluma. The one who starts a song does not tell these people how to harmonize.
Uh-huh.
You know, they just come in exactly the way they should. And then you ask yourself, who is the composer now? You know, so it's a shared kind of a composition.
And when it gets passed down?
To the next generation. Mm. That's the power of the music. Music is a natural drug. So if you document your history in the music, it's easier to become a subject of consumption, because for as long those songs are being sung, people would ask questions and they will be taught of their history. So it brings the next question about academia. We write these theses about our history and they are kept there. Who are they helping in the community?
Nobody.
Nobody. Hmm. It helps that individual with a doctorate or whatever, or doctor so and so, but the community. How can we put these histories as like potions, like a medicine, and say we're gonna take the extract from Professor Kulu and say this is what he said. It affects the community. You never get to hear about that. And as well, the museology as an instrument to safeguard our history. These researchers go out there and collect all the artifacts and the histories, and they put there in the building. And if you were to go to Hector Peters in Orlando West, ask just one of the residents there what is happening inside. They'll never tell you.
Yeah.
So Isandlwana, a battle, is a pregnant topic, where we can unpack different aspects of our history and where things are going wrong, to an extent of raising new questions like, is it right for a government to have government historians?
Yeah.
Because for me, a historian is someone who's supposed to be independent.
The minute it's government, there's propaganda.
Yeah.
But it's amazing that you've been recognized all over the world. You've traveled to all kinds of countries. I mean, yes. I just look here, Senegal, Burkina Faso, Portugal, Switzerland, France, the Netherlands.
Yes.
Where people ask you to sing these stories and to sing these histories, and also to explain how this memory is held inside a song.
Mm, mm, mm,
it's a very niched area. I mean, you must be the expert, the foremost expert in South Africa in this respect.
I am trying my best, though my focus is on reflecting on our histories, because we have become this celebrating nation. We are spending so much money just to go to a ground, just to sing and dance. And like, what did we achieve by going to a ground? I mean, apart from getting tourists taking pictures of us and selling them abroad, we don't have programs that seeks to speak to some sort of an intellectual discourse, you know, within our heritage. Because if you were to go to any government official, especially maybe within the government, the Department of Arts and Culture, and ask a question like, what is the distinction between history, culture, and heritage and traditions?
They won't know.
They think it's one and the same thing. But history comes in as an intervention to document and record. And then later culture is born from those histories.
Mm.
And then later there are cultures that can't be practiced, like the wearing of what I'm wearing and the amabeshu, the covering of the buttocks. You can't wear this thing in this weather.
No.
So now we are safeguarding this as a heritage. So it means history gives birth to culture, and culture gives birth to what we call heritage.
Yeah. And then we have Heritage Day, and people don't know what to celebrate.
Exactly. And they think heritage is the wearing of these traditional garments. But what constitutes your philosophy as an African? You know, so when we study our history, I think we'll be able to move forward, because the confusion that we're experiencing today in terms of the lifestyle, in terms of the moral values, is because we do not know our history. We are being ruled by any ideology that comes our way.
And also, don't you find like a lot of people just pick the parts of their own heritage that suit them
Very
and
true.
Leave a lot of it behind? And some of it is unpleasant. You know, we're going through a stage in the world now where people are looking back on their own history, whether it's their own family history, whether it's their own cultural history, or even the history of their nation.
Yes.
And there's some uncomfortable and unpleasant things that you have to face. And you said something earlier just now that made me think also of my own kind of history and family history. So there are people there that were not good people. You said earlier you can't glorify the Zulu people only.
No.
Although this was a glorious battle, and yes, certainly the Zulu people were unparalleled in being able to stand up to the greatest empire in the world and beat them. That's no small achievement.
No, no.
In the big scheme of things, there were also stories that are not so nice, and there were people that were not so nice. I mean, we've got varying, you know, versions of what kind of a character Dingaan was, what kind of a guy Shaka was, Sezangakhona before him. All of these people,
yes,
had good and bad, because
very
human
true
beings all have good and bad.
Very true.
And people pick their history and they go, well, we're only going to take the good stuff so we can look good.
True. In fact, you know, I mean, that's a very interesting point, because when you look at the culture, not everything about culture is glorious and is good for, is conducive for people. I'll give you an example. For instance, when King Shaka was fighting with different tribes to put together what we call the Zulu nation today, the way people who fled to the south of KZN, so when they got there, they said, what can we do so that Shaka's regiments don't recognize us? They started to cut their faces.
Ah, yes,
as a disguise. Now, today that is part of our culture. You ask yourself, because that was a disguise, how can that be turned into a culture that has a spiritual connotation? For instance, if you do not cut your face when you are born, bad luck, bad things are going to happen in your life. How true is that? You know.
But even if it is silly, some people, it connects them to their people, right?
I hear you, but my question is, you are cutting the face of this child.
Mm.
You are exposing, the child to explaining each time he meets new people. What happened? Was it a car accident? Who does it help?
Just tell me quickly,
yes,
because you mentioned the story about the people who were chased into the south of, yes, KwaZulu-Natal. But what was the story? Because the Zulu weren't actually, they were a smaller tribe. The Mtetwas were actually more powerful. Right. And the part
Zuide
of Zuide, right,
was also a stronger king, yeah.
Correct. And then Shaka managed to, when Zuide had died,
yes,
he managed to forge this new nation.
Yes.
And he basically incorporated the Mtetwas, right?
Yes. I think Dingiswayo Mteto is responsible for what Ushaka became.
Mm.
Because Queen Nandi, as the mother to King Shaka, tried to mend things with Senzangakhona to an extent that she broke a cultural law that you do not go to your boyfriend's place before ilobolo is paid,
right,
and your culturally
traditional, all that stuff too.
Yes,
right?
it's done properly. So because Senzangakhona was not interested, Nandi ended up going there so that she secured the space for her son. And then there was this encounter where the one of the dogs, bite the one of the goats, Senzangakhona's goats, and then he wanted to kill his son. And Nandi said, just because of such a minor incident and you wanna punish your own child. He said, no, this child is silly. And Nandi said, you know what, if you wanna fight, I'm here.
Yeah.
And then the family meetings, and then Nandi ended up going back home. When she went back home to Kwamhlongo, Elangeni, then there were politics there and said, we told you not to go there because you are like an embarrassment to us as a family. You broke our cultural values, and then you went there, and now that you failed, you're coming back. To an extent that King Shaka was, as a young kid, was really, really humiliated.
He didn't belong anywhere.
He had no sense of belonging. To understand that when they are preparing a porridge from the pot straight to his hands, sure, that's how hectic it was. You know, blisters on his hands. But his mother kept on saying, do not forget those who ill-treated you when you take over as a king.
And he didn't.
Yeah.
He punished a lot of people.
Yeah. And then they went to the Mthethwas for refuge. Mm. And then she went there. And at that time, Dingiswayo had ran away. In fact, he was not Dingiswayo then, he was Godongwane.
Mm.
He is Dingiswayo. Dingiswayo means the exiled one. So he was exiled by his own family because of they were fighting over the kingdom, who's going to take over. And so they stabbed him on his back. So when he came back, you know, he met King Shaka, and he's a young boy. So, but Shaka is a young boy. I mean, he really, you know, made sure that he proved himself. There was a guy who was called Lembe. He used to be part of the rich men. So he ate too much of intelezi and other things that would invoke spirits when you're going to the battle, to understand that he lost his mind. So he could not stop fighting, to understand that he went straight to the bush and reside there. And he would go out and take anyone's cows and go back to the bush and said, who wants them? He must come.
With everyone.
Yeah, he would kill everyone. And then King Shaka, as a young boy, he said, I want to take him on. And then King Dingiswayo said, no, maybe you need to go with the regiments there. And then for the first time they went there, and this guy came out, and Shaka ran back home because he was hectic. And then they tried the second time.
Lembe.
Yes. So the second time he tried, Ulembe was focused on the regiments that are veterans, who are gray like me. These are going to give me problems. Only to find that Ushaga was the one who was dangerous. He climbed on top of him on his shoulders, and he stabbed him so fast, and then he fell. That's how we got the name Ilembe Lugamanyamalembe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Because Dingiswayo, when they told him the story, he said, wow, we are able to conquer Lembe. So you are now an axe that jumps other axes, because Ilembe, Eleka, Ugweka is to...
Right.
Skip, yes. So his history was really interesting. However, not everything about him is holy.
Just tell me, because I love this stuff. I could listen to you all day.
Yeah.
Maybe I should make sure I'm at the show every one of those three nights. Just tell me quickly about how Shaka was killed and betrayed by his brothers. What actually happened in the oral tradition?
I think at the age of 16, there's a gift to King Shaka that they don't talk about, that he had, the prophetic gift.
Mm-hmm.
Not the Sangoma type, a natural prophetic gift. When he was looking after a huge herd of cattle, there was a huge black mamba that killed one of the cattle. He had a conversation with that.
With the mamba?
With the mamba. What are you doing? That snake could tell him everything about his kingdom. He told him about Mshangan, his brother Dingan, and Mbopa, that these people are going to kill you at some point. But your kingdom will be one of the greatest kingdom, but you're going to die young. Then to give you, an empirical evidence to the claim that I'm putting right now. When he took over as a king, he found Mbopa Kasithayi next to the fire. And then he said, what are you doing, Mbopa? He said, hey, it's cold. I'm trying to get warm. He said, no, that's not how you get warm. Put your hands inside the fire. He said, no, but I'm getting hurt. Put the hands in the fire, until his hands were like this. And it's because he was ahead. He knew that he was going to be part of those who are going to kill him. And then on the day, before the day, they were going to assassinate him, during the evening, he was seen making funny noise, communicating with his ancestors. You know, asking, what is, I can't let Dingaan. Dingaan is a coward. I can't be killed by cowards. Why did you have to let such cowards, I mean, to kill me? Why don't I die on a battlefield? But the ancestors kept on telling him that the time is come, until he accepted. What happened the following day? He used to be at the forefront of the battle, all the battles. He was a spiritual fighter. His names, his proper names was Sigidi Mlilwana. I mean, Shaka is a nickname. So when he was fighting, he would like, Sigidi, that was his motto. And once he says that, he would fight with the spirit to an extent that like more than 40 people would be lying on the, just him alone.
He killed up to that many
a
people.
A day in a bed, like Sigidi. And there were elders who would say, this child is unruly. You're going to die. There were people who that he could listen to. But he's being presented as this fully efficient, operating alone kind of a human being. But he had his advisors around that time. So now, on the day, he remained back at home. He did not go to the battlefield. Because he knew that he was told to remain home because it was over. And then Dingaan and other and his brothers came to kill him. You know, they stabbed him on the back and he said, you guys are such cowards, you can't even face me. And he said, the Zulu chieftaincy was the least out of them all. But I came in and there was a king among the Zulu kingdom. Did you not see God among you, among yourselves? You did not see God. You are killing me because you did not, you don't understand the vision. Why are you not coming in front of me and face me? You know, so what I'm trying to say, this guy, he knew about his destiny, his fate. It's just that historians could not make time to, you know, articulate it, because sometimes it sounds like a bedtime story. But this is what actually happened. They killed him. And then what happened after he died? They put him next to the bush so that the hyenas can come and eat him. What happened? They just came and surrounded him. And then when they came to check if they've taken him away and eaten him, they found like the foot prints of these hyenas. You can tell that they surrounded him and did nothing and protected him from other animals. And then King Dingaan said, oh my goodness, what have I done? I have killed the real king. And this snake that spoke to King Shaka told him that King Dingaan is going to be exiled.
And he was.
Like his name. Yes.
He was sent to...
next to Ngwavuma.
Yeah.
Towards Swaziland.
Yeah, the Hlathini.
Yes, that's where he died.
Yeah.
And he was killed ruthlessly. And he witnessed Umgungundlovu, which is in the north of KZN, and his palace getting burned. He cried and said, "Wash Umgungundlovu ndikuyibomvu." So, I mean, his life was very prophetic, King Shaka. And it's very special, man. He died around the age of 31. You know, but you look at the kingdom that he built. It's even today, in all honesty, for the fact that the government intervenes or interferes in the kingdom, like funding the kingdom, it means there's something wrong. We don't have a kingdom until the kingdom is self-efficient, is able to fund itself. But what I'm saying is, in as much as we've lost so much after the Battle of Isandlwana, because on the 22nd, the battle fought, and the English were defeated. And King Cetshwayo said, guys, do not follow these soldiers now, because it is done. The press release, the press conference was happened in the UK. They spoke about this for the first time. They were defeated. He said, don't follow them now. Because the blood was boiling, they followed them and they crossed the river Umzinyat, only to find that the regiments were defending a missionary house that was called the Rogue Strift.
Rogue Strift, yeah.
And they trapped them. It was so hot because even on the mountain, people were killed by the sun. Like the stomachs were just bursting from the heat. It was very smelly, according to the narration, the accounts from the history. And then they followed them there. Then they put the gallons of paraffin. They thought there is a Zulu smin of call to Kavini at home. It's a traditional whiskey. So it looks like water. When you're looking at it in a bottle. So now they thought it was water. They were trapped and they would drink these paraffins and others would die on the spot. And then there was this guy who said, "Okandaba kodaka shongo njalo," meaning King Cetshwayo never commanded us to come here. He said, "Let's go back because the battle is over." Amahubo that we just spoke about. As this guy was saying, "Okandaba kashongo njalo," they just on the spot said, "Okandaba kashongo njalo, Zulu salwa nempi, amadube sandlana." What does it mean? Zulu salwa nempi, amadube sandlana. Zulu, we fought the battle of zebras at the mountain in Sandlana. What does it mean? It's very poetic. It means the black and white lying on top of the mountain got decorated as if there were zebras on the mountain, and the horses that were used by the rich men, black and white, lying on top of the mountain, and that song, the way it was written. So the music called Amahubo, it's so deep. I was so worried when they said King David from the Bible wrote Amahubo, the Psalms, they called them Amahubo. The etymology background of the word Ihubo or Amahubo is derived from the reaction of the weather. When it's raining, you would hear when the rain hits the leaves. And then the more it rains and the rivers get full, and the vowel that said, it changes to. And then when they compose songs, they are inspired by the sounds that they hear from the mountains, from the rivers. To an extent, you when you're listening to the vibrations of the old men when they sing, because they are deriving it's more of an onomatopoeic.
Yes.
Kind of a semantic applicability of the word that is derived from the sound, you know. Therefore, you can't say King David wrote Amahubo because he was talking about himself. When you read the book of David, it's his experiences. He slept with someone else's wife, and then he went back to God and said, "God, I've done so wrong." And then he worshiped God, and then he would write poems that Amahubo are embodied by the spirit of ancestral praise. Therefore, it is imperative for them to be sung and for them to have the message about the people who were there before us.
I'm just, I wish we had all day, honestly. Yeah. Talk to you the whole time. Joburg Theatre, it's happening 24 to 26 January 2020. You can purchase your tickets at webtickets.co.za or at a Pick and Pay store. Mbuso, what a pleasure to see you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Wow. Thank you so much. I don't have nerves.
No.
If I was on Idols, yeah.
Listen, if you were on Idols, you would have won, man.
I would have won.
Substance and good music.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
See you, boy.
Mbuso Khoza. Thank you. There we go. Go and see the show. It's terrific. Absolutely amazing stuff.
Next week, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
CliffCentral.com.
This is CliffCentral.com.